Welcome to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice, your local connection to the world, on WSCALP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to be with you to introduce our show to you today, December 24th, 2005. Today we focus on meanings of Christmas. Here's what's coming up. We begin with a repeat of an interview from last Christmas, Brian Gregg talking with Durham Minister Larry Brickner Wood. They focus on Jesus as an activist and social justice advocate. We'll also bring you a segment on Walmart, on people's history. We'll bring you music pertaining to the holidays, and end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. First, here's some news.
This is Steve Diamond with some news headlines from the past week, starting with some local news. From Foster's Daily Democrat on December 19th, Iraq protest at Bradley office in Dover. A day before elections in Iraq, groups of MoveOn.org activists dropped off petitions to local congressional offices, including Representative Jeb Bradley's Dover office. The goal of the petition, and that of the 25 or so people who turned out on a frigid Wednesday afternoon, was getting U.S. troops out of Iraq in 2006. Bradley himself was not present in his office, but the group of mostly local residents did drop off an email petition with between 1,100 and 1,200 signatures. It is irresponsible for Representative Bradley to continue defending the president and his failed stay-the-course policy in Iraq, said Jim Sconyers, MoveOn member from Dover, in a news release. Also from Foster's Daily Democrat, on December 19th, Northwood Group appeals USA Springs approval. A local group has appealed the town planning board's site review approval for USA Springs, Inc., 176,000-square-foot water bottling plant. Neighborhood Guardians, whose leadership lives by the plant site, filed the appeal Thursday in Rockingham County Superior Court. Group members Rowena Howes said the legal action is based in part on jurisdictional matters related to the planning board's review and the state's groundwater withdrawal permitting. The Guardians, registered with the state as a nonprofit, was formed expressly to challenge the local board's November 16th decision, said Howes. It was formed December 1st at a meeting hosted by the grassroots Save Our Groundwater group, comprised of area residents challenging USA Springs' plan to withdraw almost 310,000 gallons of water per day from the aquifer. After much discussion, residents of the immediate area present at the meeting decided that a new group would be formed specifically to undertake an appeal of the planning board's decision, said Dennis Hart of Save Our Groundwater. And next, we have some news about the much-debated Iraqi elections. From The Guardian Unlimited on December 23rd, Iraqis march, say election was rigged. Large demonstrations broke out across the country Friday to denounce parliamentary elections that protesters say were rigged in favor of the main religious Shiite coalition. Several hundred thousand people demonstrated after noon prayers in southern Baghdad Friday, many carrying banners decrying last week's elections. Many Iraqis outside the religious Shiite coalition alleged that the elections were unfair to smaller Sunni Arab and secular Shiite groups. One banner said, "We refuse the cheating and forgery in the elections." Sunni Arab and secular Shiite factions demanded Thursday that an international body review election fraud complaints and threatened to boycott the new legislature. The United Nations rejected the idea. Their demand came 2 days after preliminary returns indicated that the current governing group, the religious Shiite United Iraqi Alliance, was getting bigger than expected majorities in Baghdad, which has large numbers of Shiites and Sunnis. On Friday, more than 2,000 people demonstrated in Mosul, where some accused Iran of having a hand in election fraud. Criticism of last week's elections are seen by some as jockeying for position by both Sunnis and former Prime Minister Iyad Alawi, a secular Shiite, before negotiations on forming a new coalition government begin. And from MSNBC on December 22nd, Chalabi's defeat puts U.S. friends in a quandary. Should his backers go with his view that it was a fraudulent election? Iraqi politician Ahmed Chalabi appears to have suffered a humiliating defeat at the recent Iraqi polls. The election results in Iraq may present Chalabi's ardent U.S. supporters with a quandary. Chalabi, as well as other losing candidates, is alleging fraud in the election, even though the Bush administration hailed the vote as a historic step for democracy in Iraq. During the election, Chalabi's campaign posters proclaimed, quote, "We liberated Iraq." The reference was to Chalabi's role in pushing the United States towards war against Saddam Hussein. Over the years, Chalabi's group received tens of millions of dollars from the CIA and the State Department. In that role, before 2003, Chalabi had been funded by the U.S. Congress through the Iraq Liberation Act and enjoyed the support of neoconservatives in the United States. And more about elections, this time in the United States. From the Miami Herald on December 15th. New tests fuel doubts about voting machines. A political operative with hacking skills could alter the results of any election on Diebold-made voting machines, and possibly other new voting systems in Florida, according to the state capital's election supervisor, who said Diebold software had failed repeated tests. That's kind of scary. If there's no paper trail, you have to rely solely on electronic results. And now we know that they can be manipulated under the right conditions, without a person even leaving a fingerprint, said Sancho, who once headed the state's Elections Supervisor Association. A nonprofit election monitoring group called BlackBoxVoting.org hired Herbert Thompson, a computer science professor and strategist at Security Innovation, which tests software for companies such as Google and Microsoft. Thompson told the Herald he was, quote, shocked at how easy it was to get in, make the loser the winner, and leave without a trace. He typed 5 lines of computer code and switched 5,000 votes from one candidate to another. He said, I am positive an eighth grader could do this. And from USAtoday.com on December 17th, Bush acknowledges approving eavesdropping. President Bush said Saturday he had no intention of stopping his personal authorizations of a post-September 11th secret eavesdropping program in the U.S. Angry members of Congress have demanded an explanation of the program, first revealed in Friday's New York Times. Appearing angry at points during his 8-minute address, Bush said he had reauthorized the program more than 30 times since the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, and plans to continue to do so. Reacting to Bush's defense of the NSA program, Senator Russell Feingold, Democrat of Wisconsin, said the president's remarks were, quote, breathtaking in how extreme they were. Feingold said it was absurd that Bush said he relied on his inherent power as president to authorize the wiretaps. He added, if that's true, he doesn't need the Patriot Act because he can just make it up as he goes along. I tell you, he's President George Bush, not King George Bush. This is not the system of government we have and that we fought for. And from MSNBC on December 19th, Bush says leaking spy program a shameful act. President vows to continue domestic eavesdropping. President Bush on Monday said disclosure of his domestic eavesdropping program was a, quote, shameful act and that he will keep using it. He said, as President of the United States and Commander-in-Chief, I have the constitutional responsibility and the constitutional authority to protect our country. When asked if the Justice Department would be investigating who leaked the existence of the program, first disclosed Friday by the New York Times, Bush said he presumed the process had started. It was a shameful act for someone to disclose this important program in a time of war. The fact that we're discussing this program is helping the enemy, he said at the White House event. And finally, from the United Press International on December 18th, Iraq veterans running for Congress. An Iraq war veteran who lost her legs when a rocket-propelled grenade blew up in the helicopter she was piloting is running for Congress in Illinois. In seeking the congressional seat being vacated by retiring Republican Representative Henry Hyde, Duckworth joins a host of military veterans running as Democrats for House seats in GOP-leaning districts, the Chicago Tribune reported. Duckworth calls the Iraq war a mistake. Nobody in Congress right now has the perspective that those of us who've served in Iraq have, Duckworth told the newspaper Friday as she sought signatures for her candidacy petitions at a Streamwood, Illinois restaurant. Only those of us who've been serving on the ground over there understand the dynamics that are truly going on over there right now. At least 10 other veterans who served in the military after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks now are running for Congress as Democrats. Paul Hackett, a former Marine Corps major, came close to winning a special election this summer for an Ohio congressional seat that had been held by the GOP for decades.
This is Making Waves on WSCA 106.1 LPFM. We now go to Brian Gregg in an interview with Larry Brookner Wood.
I'm Brian Gregg for Making Waves Radio. As Christians of the Western Church join together today with loved ones to celebrate the birth of Jesus, chaos and violence continue to rage on in Iraq. A president who has said Jesus is his favorite philosopher led this nation into war on increasingly questionable grounds and continues to be backed by many self-proclaimed Christians here in the United States as the line between church and state grows ever more blurry. One can't help but wonder, what about love thy neighbor? What about blessed be the peacemakers? turn the other cheek, thou shalt not kill. Has the message of Jesus of Nazareth been distorted beyond repair? In an interview recorded on December 15th, I spoke with Larry Brickner Wood, chaplain and executive director of the United Campus Ministry to the University of New Hampshire in Durham. I'd like to ask you your view of the message of Jesus. What was his central teaching?
Well, Jesus probably had a number of teachings, and it's hard to distill it necessarily to one central teaching, but really at its core, and I think a lot of folks would agree with this, is a real message of love, and a message that the kind of love that God exhibits for every single human being and really for all of creation is not just a love that's in a cosmic place in heaven, but is a love that's meant to be brought to the very reality of our everyday existence. So Jesus's essential message is a community, a beloved community, as Martin Luther King and others have referred to it, that's grounded in a reality of today, and that is meant to be brought to the earth, on earth as it is in heaven. And that's, I think, central at its core, and I think much of Jesus's life and ministry flowed from that message.
And I wonder often, how is it that one text, the Bible, has come to mean such different things to different groups. While one faction may use the Bible in the past to justify slavery or war or a sort of permanent poverty for most of humanity, and others look at the same book and find inspiration for peace and social justice and environmental consciousness. And I wonder what your view is of how people arrive at such differing meanings of that text.
Well, I think often people's theology follows their ideology. So I think we look at text and through the lenses of that we bring to it. That's one construct, is that we look at any text, whether it's the Bible, the Quran, text that the Buddha wrote or Buddhists used, with our own lenses. It's hard to completely objectify and be objective in a review of a sacred text. The Bible itself that we read, at least in our country and in other countries around the world, is translated into English out of really three languages, Hebrew, Greek, and Aramaic. And those languages don't always easily translate into English. And so often things do get lost in the translation, to talk about a cliche. The other piece of that is there are a number of translations of the Bible around the world. In our tradition, we often use a New Revised Standard Version. Many traditions use the New International Version. There's the Catholic Bible. There's the King James, which is the poetic language that is often quoted at services. And there are a number of translations that sometimes do say different things. But beyond that, it's people using the Bible in ways that kind of follow their ideology. The other piece, I think, is that it depends on whether you look at any sacred text literally and whether you're trying to read it literally or you're reading it with an eye that looks also at the cultural, historical, and literary context that it was written in. I've read some things recently about a number of Muslim scholars challenging some of the literal readings of the Quran, saying that they're taking them out of context, that they're not looking at the cultural and historical context in which they were written. And in doing that, you're taking something that was written hundreds of years ago and trying to apply it literally to the conditions of today, and there's a danger in that. So I think the how you read it is as important as what lenses you're reading it through.
And in that light, I'm thinking about the sort of literalist or, I suppose, fundamentalist reading of the Bible, or I guess for that matter, any text, the Quran or any other, and how that has come to maybe distort the sort of core truth behind the intentions of the text. And I wonder if you can say something about how this kind of movement toward purity or or absolute truth or whatnot fits into the overall picture of Christianity, let's say, and how your view it might be different from that.
When you say purity, you mean some of the pieces of the Christian tradition or in the Bible that talk about purity laws and things such as that?
I'm thinking more about, you know, a sort of philosophical extreme kind of intention to make the world pure according to someone's point of view, you know, no matter what its origin is, if you know what I mean.
Well, Jesus, I think, addressed issues of purity. It was some of the tensions that Jesus would have with leaders of the day, including religious leaders of the day, were what were challenges to purity laws. And I say purity laws, not simply laws about what to eat and that kind of thing, but the legalistic rigidity of what the laws that you're to observe, sometimes at the expense of the humanity or the compassion that was, in theory, undermining those or undergirding those purity laws. One example is when he was admonished for healing on the Sabbath with the seventh day in which God rested. Jesus was admonished by religious leaders of the day for healing on the Sabbath because it was against the purity laws or the codes. You were to do not to do that kind of quote-unquote work on the Sabbath. And Jesus' response was essentially, how could you not heal on the Sabbath? How could you walk by someone who was in need and sick and simply because you were observing a particular custom or a particular practice and not heal that person, that God was asking you to do what was compassionate and flowed out of your heart, of an open heart, rather than telling the sick person, well, wait until Sunday in this case, or wait until the next day, and then I can heal you. So Jesus was, in a number of cases, challenging those laws as part of what created the tensions. In terms of trying to impose a religious view, a literal religious view on a society, then that's problematic probably no matter what society it is. And a society like ours that espouses not necessarily a separation of church and state, but a tolerance for diversity of religious and spiritual viewpoints, including a viewpoint that may have no spiritual basis to it at all, that in a society that has that as a fundamental principle, then it is problematic for any one particular religion to really impose its will on a people of diversity. And though I think it's fair for myself and others to live in ways we think are consistent with our tradition, to then believe deeply that that should be imposed on a societal way is problematic. I think it's problematic for me, and I think it's one of the challenges that spiritual folks and religious folks have is, many of us believe that the Christian path and other spiritual paths are called to be countercultural, that we operate best when we're outside the circles of power, outside what Walter Wink would call the domination system, that when we're inside the halls of power, there's any degree of corruption that could happen to the principles and values that we espouse. And it's, many people would claim that Christians have been inside the halls of power since Constantine made it the state religion in Rome in the fourth century. So that's problematic, whether it's countercultural or it is so embedded in the culture about whether we can separate when the culture or the society itself is astray. Fundamentalism, and I'm not sure, I don't even know what that term may mean, but my understanding of it is folks who try to read things literally and have a strict, conservative, construct view of the Bible. So that's difficult. The Bible, as I understand it, is a combination of writings written over thousands of years. Some of it's poetry. Some of it is song, hymn-like. Some of it is story. Some of it is historical narrative, though it's not a history book. Some of it is in parables and in teachings that you would find in any number of traditions. It's not so much that the message is literal, it's the underlying truth. So it's this range of beautiful ways of writing. And so, but reading, anyone who reads a poem literally is in trouble, right? We don't read poems literally, and even listening to a song literally can put you into trouble. So reading the Bible literally, and I'm not sure what that means sometimes, but reading the Bible literally, and when you recognize the different forms it takes just as a literary device, is problematic. It's like reading a poem or a song literally. So,
I wonder about the difference between evangelical and what that means and fundamentalist. You know, we spoke a little bit before this interview about that, and I take it from what we talked about before that, you know, not all evangelicals are fundamentalists, let's say, in the sense that they believe that the Bible is, you know, every word in the Bible is sort of directly from God and can't be questioned type of thing. And, you know, the sort of coverage of Christianity in the mainstream media would seem to suggest that the evangelical vote, for example, just as this one monolithic block and not at all progressive. And I take it from our prior conversation that really isn't the case at all, as you understand it.
Well, the term evangelical is a broad term. There's some denominations that might use that word in their title. There are some denominations or some churches that are non-denominational that consider themselves evangelical. But the term historically has been applied to any number of churches, including Roman Catholicism. And it simply means the willingness to spread and share the good news of Jesus. I think in popular culture, or in today's society, fundamentalists often are viewed as folks who are literalist and are clearly, from my view, in the minority. And it's hard to sometimes find a true fundamentalist. Part of it is they don't typically interact with others because they believe so deeply that there's an exclusive way in Jesus Christ that it is difficult even to interact with others who might hold a differing viewpoint. Evangelicals, and before I go on, I wanted to say that we across the Christian spectrum, as in any tradition, there are a number of viewpoints and differing viewpoints, and I really respect them all, even though sometimes I disagree vehemently with many of them. And I have many friends that and colleagues that would call themselves evangelical that I have deep respect for, even though we may disagree on particular issues, and I think are doing great work in the world. The evangelical movement that often popular media portrays as helping to elect the president, for instance, are probably they throw out of a conservative Christian theology. Some of them are Baptist churches, though not all of them. Southern Baptist are probably an example, though many people would say they're fundamentalist. I don't think that's the case. There are a number of non-denominational or interdenominational churches, kind of the new church movement that doesn't align itself with any historical denominations. And there are some huge churches that have grown kind of in a very grassroots way, organically out of that. And they typically take a conservative, quote-unquote, conservative view towards Christian theology. And they have been effective in getting the ear of many people in power in our country, not just the president, but I think I read recently that the Speaker of the House and Congress and the Majority Leader in the Senate and the president were all people that would call themselves evangelical. Even though the president, my understanding, he's a United Methodist, which is often called a mainline Protestant denomination around the country and wouldn't typically be given the moniker of evangelical, but that his actions and his words sound more like an evangelical. So if you look at that, three of our most powerful leaders in our country profess that particular theology or ascribe to that particular doctrine. And so those folks are going to have an ear. That maybe the rest or other parts of Christianity don't seem like they have.
And in that sort of political arena, when you observe the president of the U.S. in one breath proclaiming his faith in Jesus and sort of in the next breath announcing a giant tax break for the wealthy or denouncing gay rights or a woman's right to choose or saying something seemingly inexplicable like "Bring them on." What is your reaction as a Christian and as a minister, if that's accurate to say?
Well, the president's like all of us. We have growing edges, and we're flawed Christians, flawed human beings. I think there are clearly differences of opinion around issues like a woman's right to choose, issues around gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered rights and issues, issues of war and peace. A comment like "bring them on," it's a bit like dealing with your children or children that know better, but their first response to something is, "Do you want to fight?" It's not, certainly it's not something that's steeped in Christian doctrine as I understand it. Jesus didn't say "bring it on." I don't know, you might look through the Bible and find some Old Testament sayings that allude to that, but that, I think that was just, that's the president's style. I think, if I could talk a little bit about Jesus, there are many people who interpret Jesus's teachings as pacifist, and they are to some extent, but they're not passive, at least in my understanding. Jesus certainly doesn't preach violence and doesn't preach that a response to oppression is to take the same tactic as the oppressor, which is often a violent one, a submissive one, a one that dominates. But by the same token, Jesus' response is not to be cowardly or passive or submissive. So Walter Wink and many others talk about Jesus' third way, that between those two extremes is a third way. And a Buddhist might say the middle path, but it is really trying to face squarely the system of power, the domination system or the oppressor, and to use some of the tactics that they impose, but in a way that's not violent and in a way that turns the issue of dignity back towards them on their head. There's a biblical passage that there's a range of passages that talk about turn the other cheek or carry the soldier's pack an extra mile, or when someone takes your outer cloak, give them your undercloak. Those three passages, again, read in the cultural context of the time, would force the person who is demeaning the individual and oppressing the individual to take another step that really humiliated them, not the person being oppressed. In the cultural context of the times, the Roman soldiers who would ask someone, and I guess routinely, from what you can tell, would routinely ask the people on the road to carry their packs. It was one of the abuses of the centurions and Roman soldiers. And you could historically look at, there's so much talk about it that it seemed clear like there was a lot of that abuse going on. So they, but there was a law that said they could only ask the person to carry it a mile, and that to ask a second mile would then put them in violation of the law. So Jesus asking someone to carry that pack a second mile willingly would force that person, then the soldier, to make a choice. Do I violate the law? Do I go through the humiliation of asking this person to do something beyond what my law requires I can do? Forces them to make a choice. And by doing it in a way that says, I'll carry this a second mile because I'm not going to let your oppression of me dominate me and beat me. That is a much more powerful way than just saying, well, go ahead and carry it a second mile just so they can oppress you further. Turn the other cheek isn't just a way of saying, hit me again. It's a way of saying, in that culture, in order to hit, you would hit someone with your right hand. To use your left hand was unclean. So if you hit someone with your right hand, it would hit their left cheek. So in theory, your cheek would turn. And in order then to hit the other cheek, you would either have to use the back of your hand, which is something that you could only use to an inferior. You could not strike a peer with the back of your left hand or the back of your hand, of either hand. Or the use of a left hand in an awkward way, which again was an impure act. So turning the cheek again says to the oppressor, the person striking you, that first hit did not beat me. It did not achieve the desired effect. And you're going to have to hit me again with your left hand or the back of your hand because I refuse to submit. So that's a much more active resistance than often is portrayed in the passive way of just let someone hit you again and hit you again. I don't think Jesus is saying that at all, not to lie down and let them roll over. And I think passivism has been misconstrued over the years to say Jesus was passive or even cowardly. Jesus was not preaching cowardice.
And I wonder about, you know, if you look at the sort of competing legacies of the Christian church itself, sort of one, on the one hand, there's a strong tradition of social justice within certain certain areas, and peace and environmental consciousness on the one hand, and sort of on the other, this legacy of war and inquisition and colonial conquest and so forth on the other. And I wonder how you sort of, as a Christian, how you come to terms with what might be seen as the abuses of the church, and sort of how to place that into the present in a way that's looking toward healing, let's say.
There's no question that our Christian history is troublesome around the world, and over hundreds of years, in any number of ways, how we've treated indigenous peoples around the world is problematic. How we've treated women, how we've treated folks from other traditions, how we've treated each other at times, in conflicts that not only erupt between Christians and another tradition, but within Christian tradition, Northern Ireland, where the underpinning of Protestant and Roman Catholic violence is just troublesome. You know, it's part of my response is we just pray for forgiveness, because that's not what we're called to do. The aspect of it that troubles me probably the hardest is that, one, I don't find any foundation for that kind of abuse and oppression, regardless of how right you might think you are in my understanding of the Bible, my understanding of our tradition. And secondly, I don't think Jesus had anything to do with any of that. Part of it for me is when Christians became a part, and since the fourth century became a part of the power, that it's not only been Christians who and Christian leaders who have been perpetuating these abuses, it's our complicity, sometimes our partnership with the domination system, the people in power that have led us to be part of the abuse and the domination and the conquest, so that as conquerors and explorers came to other lands and met indigenous peoples, that Christians were sometimes lockstep with them in perpetuating the domination, so that we would try to minister to them through mission ways, while the government at the same time was putting people on reservations and trying to get them to assimilate into the larger culture. And that's just not, unfortunately, not just in our country. It's happened in other countries. But that the church and the government and the powers that be were in lockstep. And there were voices saying this is wrong, but they were muted. I think a modern-day parallel is the war in Iraq. Before the war, there were a number of Christian voices across the spectrum. You couldn't just say it was liberal Christian voices. You couldn't just say it was Protestant, Roman Catholic. It was evangelical, Protestant, Roman Catholic, non-denominational, as well as non-Christian voices that were expressing opposition or grave reservations to an invasion in Iraq when it looked like that was likely. And there were many writings. It was really across the spectrum. There were some people calling for war, but they were not the dominant voice in Christianity around the world. A number of Christian leaders led by Jim Wallis and others, Jim Wallis is the founder and director of the Sojourners Community in Washington, D.C., asked repeatedly to meet with President Bush and his staff and were not given access at that time, even though I had met with him on other things. Tony Blair, I believe, met with them. But we're not even able to get his ear to register their concern and complaints. And he even had drafted a statement at the time, I think an 8-point statement about the war. And weren't even able to get access and an audience. The troublesome thing for me, and someone who claims Jesus is his leader, a role model, a favorite philosopher, to turn a deaf ear to a range of Christian voices was just, besides being insulting, was just something that I think did great damage to us as a people of faith and a people of spirit, and also gave people the impression that I'm willing to listen to the voices when they agree with me. and I'll look for those spiritual voices that agree with me. And the ones that don't, you're outside the palace, which in some ways is okay. I think our voice is stronger, our prophetic voice is stronger when we're outside the palace than sometimes than when we're within. The professor at Andover Newton Theological School where I went, Orlando Costas, who is now dead, he'd written a book and talked about Christ outside the gates, that Jesus operated much more effectively sometimes when he was outside the gates of the city, the gates of power. Often because that's where the people that were being oppressed and dominated were. They were on the outside. And that's where Jesus found his center. And that's where Jesus consciously worked. He didn't come to the palace. He didn't come to the halls of power. He came to the people that had been excluded. So the exclusion of Christian voices about issues like the war, issues like poverty, issues like the abuse of our earth is not surprising. And I think we need to stand outside the palace and then speak up even more vehemently.
You know, some people have observed that the Bush administration is going about its campaign in Iraq and also its support for, what has been a very oppressive government in Israel is sort of very consciously designed to bring about, kind of an Armageddon scenario, that there are, a certain extremist fringe of believers, I suppose, who seem to want to accelerate the second coming. I remember reading about people in Tennessee raising, spotless red heifers, ready to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem and reinstitute animal sacrifice and, bring about the return of Jesus. And I mean, it's sort of an outlandish sounding scenario, but do you ever have the sense that there's a kind of a lunatic element to some of the philosophy or politics that undergird some of what they're doing?
I think there's some frightening elements that seem to favor the current administration policy that are disturbing. And there is a strain of Christianity that sees this life as evil, that this life is sinful, that this life is not redeemable, and that our ultimate goal is to work and wait for the second coming, in which certain people may be then brought to eternal life and paradise, heaven, and others will be, quote unquote, left behind. I don't think, and that exists, and it's always existed throughout Christianity, there are probably two prevailing strains of Christianity that look at what it means to be enlightened or what it means to be a true believer and follower of the way. One would be a personal enlightenment and a personal spiritual quest that really talks about a personal relationship with God. And Martin Luther, the originator of the Protestant Reformation, one of his concerns with the church at the time, at least the Western church, was a belief that it had gotten away from that personal relationship. So people would go to church and watch their clerical leaders with their backs to them, just worshiping God while the rest just watched, did not participate, did not take communion, couldn't read this text because they weren't written and translated. And so just was essentially a performance. And one of his concerns was that God had been removed from a context of a personal relationship. So that's a strong strain. Another strain, just as equally as strong, for many people stronger, would be that God calls us to bring the kingdom of God or what the beloved community of God to reality here on earth. And that takes a strong commitment to a social gospel, a gospel that where Jesus claims that all are children of God and all who are excluded are meant to be in the beloved community. And to the extent they aren't, then we have work to do. And too often people have taken one or the other. So you follow, if you're liberal, you may say you follow the social gospel, social justice gospel. If you're not, you're following the personal salvation, and the private sin is more important than a corporate sin. So what I may privately have done is more important than if I'm the CEO of a corporation that's routinely polluting a river. that my personal sin is more important than that corporate sin. I don't believe that. I think actually the two elements, the two foundations are important for us as Christians. I'm more cynical probably about what guides our policy as a people. I'm not sure. This is not a Christian war. The Christians did not invade Iraq. Many of the people who gave the orders may be Christians, but it's not a holy war. It's not a religious war. And any pretense that it is an injustice to the tradition of Jesus and really any other religious tradition. I think probably there are just more garden variety interests at play, whether they be business interest, whether they be military interest, whether it be strategic interest, whether they be interest of oil, whether they be payback, whether they be political spinning, saying we've got to make someone pay for the attack on our country in September 11th, 2001, whether we are paying them back still for some of the things in the original Desert Storm, whether it is trying to get a position that favors us in a part of the world that's always been problematic for us. But I think those are sometimes very calculating, hardcore reasons, and religion sometimes is a great pretense to say it's a spiritual reason that we're invading folks. It's a spiritual reason that we're defending this. It's a spiritual reason. And I don't think there's anything religious or spiritual about this war at all, really any war, but certainly not this one. So if folks were lunatics, I think it would be more evident and folks would be really concerned. I think it's the fact that they seem in some ways rational and they seem to be folks that are people of deep faith that's even more concerning. And, you know, sometimes there's televangelists, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson. I don't think folks follow them greatly. I know people watch them. Obviously, they wouldn't stay on the radio and TV. But those aren't the representative of the real mass of people that support the president and folks that may come out of a conservative philosophy. I think they see them as caricatures, too. I think more because most people don't believe that God caused the planes to crash into the Twin Towers and that it was God's way of punishing us for feminism and gays on the planet and all these other things. I don't think most people believe that and probably cringe when they hear Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson saying that kind of baloney. But I think there is a deep sense that the president's a Christian. He speaks about his Christianity somewhat openly, and therefore that's got to be at play a little bit in the decisions he's making. I don't know how it is. I'd love to be in a conversation with him where you might say, if Jesus is your favorite philosopher, if you're a Christian, then tell me how you get to the decisions. If X is true, tell me how you get Y, because I can't find it. I can't find it in the equations that I know of. And I'd love to have that conversation. I'll never have that conversation with the president, but I'd love to have someone be having that conversation. So if you are a Christian, tell me how a Christian would get there. And I can see a political leader saying, I am a Christian, but I'm also the leader of a secular country that values diversity in all faiths. And sometimes my decisions, while informed by my faith, aren't strictly made because of my faith. Other politicians have tried to say that, and sometimes they get hammered for it, but...
And I wonder, you know, it's a complete mystery to me the vehemence with which some elements of, I suppose, more conservative Christian churches pursue an agenda of trying to hold back gay rights in this country. And it's just a mystery to me why they're as passionate as they are about, you know, threat to marriage or whatever the theory is. And, you know, the sort of answer that's given is that, well, you know, the Bible says marriage is between a man and a woman, but then, you know, other people have pointed out other parts about, you know, well, if you're basically you have to marry the wife of your brother if he dies, or, you know, just sort of various codes that clearly wouldn't work in today's society and yet are biblically based, you know. But I wonder if you have any idea what is behind that that movement, you know?
Well, I grew up in Virginia, in the South, and that vehemence existed in my lifetime around the issues of civil rights. And I can I was young, but I remember still colored only and white only written on doors and windows and places, and two educational systems. And I remember when they were, in theory, integrated. And the people were pretty vehement then that this was not only the way it had to be, it was the way it was ordained to be. I think people were pretty vehement that giving women the right to vote was not only wrong, but wrong spiritually. And there have been battles around the ordination of women in traditions that it would be contrary to God's callings, God's precepts. There, in fact, the consecration of Reverend Gene Robinson, which happened here on campus, and we were involved with a number of people in training peacekeepers to be present at that event, as well as organizing people just to stand in support of that act. But there were many women who remembered the ordination of women in the Episcopal Church that was met with the same vehemence, saying that this is wrong. This will be the undoing of our church. And it was very, very humbling and powerful to just listen to them saying, we went through this. Women who were ordained at the time, and when the church did not, the world didn't end and the church did not collapse. And many of the women are serving wonderfully in the Episcopal Church as well as other denominations. But they remembered the pain and the voices of hate and anger and the voices of dissent saying, this is not what God wants. This is the work of the Antichrist, the devil, whatever. So those voices have always been vehemently saying, the Bible says this, God says this. The Bible is a living document. There's a campaign in my tradition, the United Church of Christ, God is still speaking. And the beauty of that campaign is that it's that God is not finished. We may have a canon called the Bible, the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures of the Old Testament referred to sometimes. That might be our canon, but God is still speaking. God is still writing new chapters. And for us to think it's fixed at any point in time allows us to perpetuate great abuses, such as the submission of women. Women at one time couldn't speak in church. In terms of marriage, Martin Luther and others, I'm told Martin Luther said this, and others have said, the church ought to be out of the business sometimes of civil marriage. That's a civil act, and the government should do that. And that we can bless things, we can have our own ceremonies. People don't go down to the town hall after we've done a baptism, and or after we've done confirmation. So that the church ought to just be out of the business of marriage. There are civil issues that have to do with marriage. And Martin Luther and others have said that. In fact, people are saying that now from the left often. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. But I do know that there are issues of justice there. I think fear and ignorance are powerful motivators. And people sometimes are just afraid of what change will bring. And the thought of people who aren't heterosexual being married really, really, really unsettles some people. I've seen gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgendered people deeply in love with each other and long commitments, and it's a wonder to behold. And they're just as in love as many heterosexual people that I know. And to deny them the right to proclaim that love in the same ways that I do, I find is not what Jesus would favor and is unjust. Jesus didn't talk about this issue. There are people quote Bible passages. Jesus didn't talk about this issue, and who knows what he would say if he were here. But I can't believe he'd say that people should be excluded from celebrating their love for each other simply because of who they are.
And finally, sort of returning to the issue of Jesus's role as a kind of a radical and peace-oriented leader. I wonder, sort of as you know, in the way of any concluding thoughts about celebrating Christmas, you know, and what that means to you in the context of peace on this particular day.
Well, Christmas, it's one of my favorite times of year. We're celebrating, it may not be the actual day, but we're celebrating the birth of Jesus, which is a wonderful testimony to a coming into the world of another human being. Jesus was fully human, another human being who says that it's all about love, and it's about how we live that love out in the world. That's a wonderful thing to celebrate. The gift giving, to the extent it comes out of that place, is a wonderful manifestation of that. To the extent it comes out of consumerism or obligation, it has nothing to do with the birth of Christ. It may be some other kind of event, but it's not about that. But it doesn't mean that we're not meant to give as well as receive in loving, humble ways. So it's a wonderful time to celebrate that. I think Jesus's message, the sad thing for me is Jesus is looked on as a radical. I've heard someone say Jesus was radically inclusive, and that's probably true, but to me the real radical piece is the piece that doesn't believe that, that doesn't believe that we're here to love, that doesn't believe that we're here to make everyone sure that everyone has enough to live, not that some of us have a lot and most of us have nothing. The fact that we have people that believe that some of us should have most of what the Earth's resources are and most of us have very little, that's radical to me. That's radical and should be purged from our thought. So I'm bothered that people would claim Jesus was a radical. I think if Jesus is a radical, it shows you how far away we've come.
When I use the term radical, I use it approvingly, but but I guess you're pointing to this sort of extreme nature of people who advocate an imbalance of resources somehow and use Jesus or Christianity to justify it.
Well, no, Martin Luther King would admonish our government that's, in a way, he said, all I'm asking you to do is be true to what you said on paper. So my sense of what Jesus might say is be true to what you said on paper here, in this text, in this Bible, in the way many Christian leaders have said throughout the centuries. Be true to that message instead of this lived-out message that perpetuates something out, whether it's war, violence, the oppression of women, whether it's the exclusion of folks from the elements of society that are available to people like me, whether it's a destruction of the Earth's resources, whether it's an exploitation of people on an island in the South Pacific or in our own country, whether it's people that would say, well, we love everyone because we're all sinners, but we think some folks should be excluded, whether it's a theology that says, well, some of us are going to be taken up at the rapture and a lot of you aren't going. To me, that's pretty radical. So what I was trying to say is that the message, Christmas, what to me a great time is to be true to what we said on paper. So if you want to show with the world that Christmas is more than about a rush to buy the gifts and standing in line at the mall, it's saying, you know, this is really what we think it's about. Every year we celebrate the lighting of candles, the menorah for Hanukkah with friends. And it's wonderful. It's a wonderful ceremony. And they each time, even though we've learned it over the years, take some time to talk about the tradition and what it's about. It would be wonderful if we as Christians spent more time talking about the elements of what this day is about. And it has nothing to do with the gifts, really, other than I'm giving for out of my heart. And it really has nothing to do with the story of a manger and all of that. It has to do with the transformation of the world in ways that says it's time that, I don't like to use the word kingdom, but it's time that the beloved community on earth becomes a reality, because heaven knows, God's been waiting a long time, and so have many people. And when one more person dies because of our lack of compassion and love, or dies because of violence, or dies because we haven't spread our resources evenly across the planet, then it's one more person who died unnecessarily, because God has shown us a way, and we just haven't lived it out. So Christmas is a great time to say there is another way, from the way in which we live, but it's going to take some work to get there. And some of it's going to take you giving up a little bit, so that not that you have not enough, but that we all have enough. That may mean that some of us have a little less. So that's my Merry Christmas message.
Larry Brickner Wood, thanks very much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you, Brian.
imagine evil, trying not to choke on his own upheaval. Rambling along about Jesus now, his wiser advisor, his almighty pal. Claims that when he's thinking his troubles through, he just wonders, what would Jesus do? What would Jesus do? What would Jesus do? What would Jesus do? Sometimes I wonder too. To the notion that women should have no choice. When did he suggest we should rape the planet? Jesus never said anything like that, goddammit. Jesus never said let the super rich be the ruling minority. Jesus never said let the highest bidders have seniority. Jesus never said an oil company should be the governing authority. Jesus never said corporate greed should be your number one priority, did he? What would Jesus do? What would Jesus do? What would Jesus do? Why don't you ask the Buddha too? What would Jesus do? You wonder what would Jesus do? You wonder what would Jesus do?
Sometimes I wonder too.
Something about turning the other cheek. Didn't Jesus say something about loving your enemies? Come on, people, remind me, please. Jesus never supported any war campaign. Talk about taking the name of the Lord in vain. Well, I would never claim to know what Jesus would do, but I can see why they call you W.
I've seen you in the streets and at your political convention, talking of your crusade, talking of your nation and other things too terrible to mention. And you proclaim your Christianity, you proclaim your love of God, you talk of apple pie and mom. Well, I've just got one question and I want an answer. Tell me, who would Jesus bomb? Maybe Jesus would bomb the Syrians, 'cause they're not Jews like him. Maybe Jesus would bomb the Afghans on some kind of vengeful whim. Maybe Jesus would drive an M1 tank and he would shoot Saddam. Who would Jesus bomb? On the TV and on the battleships, I've seen you in the house upon the hill. And I've heard you talking about making the world safer and about all the men you have to kill. And you speak so glibly about your civilization and how you have the moral higher ground. While halfway around the world, your explosives smash the buildings. Ah, if you could only hear the sound. But maybe Jesus would sell landmines and turn on his electric chair. Maybe Jesus would show no compassion for his enemies in the lands way over there. Maybe Jesus would have flown the planes that killed the kids in Vietnam. Who would Jesus love? Yes, I hear you shout with confidence as you praise the Lord, and you talk about this God you know so well. You talk of Armageddon and your final victory when all the evil forces go to hell. Well, you'd best hope you've chosen wisely on the right side of the Lord, and when you die, your conscience, it is clear. You'd best hope your atom bombs are better than the sword at the time when your reckoning is here. I don't think Jesus would send gunships into Bethlehem or jets to race the towns of Timorese. I don't think Jesus would lend money to dictators or drive those SUVs. And I don't think Jesus would ever have dropped a single ounce of napalm. So tell me, who would Jesus love?
That was WWJD, What Would Jesus Do, by Daniel McKenzie, and Who Would Jesus Bomb, by David Rovics.